Cultivating Judgment, Cultivating Independence was a talk presented by Andrea Lipinski at the Gutenberg 2024 Education Conference, titled The Independent Mind. Andrea Lipinski is the Vice President of Training and Consulting for the CIRCE Institute, where she also serves as a head mentor in their teacher training program, the Rocky Mountain Apprenticeship. We hope you enjoy this presentation.
Thank you for welcoming me. I'm glad to be here, David. So I'll give you an overview of where we're headed, and then we'll go on our journey. I'm going to begin by rooting us in Scripture so we remember who we are, speak about the seven desires that human beings have, and considering those desires and the decisions that we need to make daily, have some summaries in two places for us as parents and as teachers so that we can help our children cultivate judgment and in so cultivating independence, which we're not so sure that that's possible anymore. Thank you, Chris. In some way, to be able to make choices for themselves is what I'm holding on to there. So before I begin, though, I have to let you know, I am the person who was born in New York to an atheist liberal mother and an alcoholic father who abandoned both of us when I was three. It's pretty good. See? God called me. I did not choose him. He's good. Let's begin in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 22 and some more. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to the Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. Chapter 2, for I, Paul, not Andrea, Paul, decided to know nothing among you except Christ and him crucified. The natural person doesn't accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them, because they are spiritually discerned. The spiritual person judges all things, but he himself is to be judged by no one. For who has understood the mind of the Lord so as to instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. So with that in mind, I want to consider our conference theme that included the pressures, as David was talking to us this morning about that. And in this hour, root those pressures more so into the desires. So the pressures of propaganda speak to the desires of the human. There's a parallelism there. There are seven desires of man that I'll speak to. There might be other facets, other ways to categorize them. Let's hold them within these seven today for this little while. They correlate to the three parts of the soul that were identified by Socrates, as well as three placements of the soul that were identified by God in Genesis. So depending on which Platonic dialogue you read, the naming of these may be a little different. So if the three parts of the soul can be categorized as the belly, the chest, and the intellect. The belly has an appetite. Can't say it when I'm in front of you. It's gone. Appetitive. Thank you. I was like, I know the word. Has an appetitive desire. And the chest is a spirited. And the intellect is after reasoning. So each of these parts, you know, can be placed somewhere on a physical body for us to help understand them. And that belly part of us, it desires pleasure. And it wants to avoid pain. And so that appetitive part is looking for money, sex, food, drink. Those are all bodily desires. And so as a teacher, whether you're in a home or in a classroom, There are lessons that we teach our students that deal with the physicalness of the body. Sometimes it's appropriate to sit and be still, to be quiet, to figure out hand dexterity, to organize ourselves within strength training, to build endurance of the body, to physically run, all parts of that. And so as a teacher then, we need to consider, what are we asking our students to do? What kind of a lesson are we involved in? And then have the reward align, harmonize with that. So we'll get to that. Let's talk a little bit about the chest then. The part of us, it's a spirited part, and it's a reflective of the passions. And so it's will-oriented. It seeks after honor, and it wants to avoid shame. So where within this can we cultivate the understanding, the feeding of that part of ourselves? It's where we want to imitate somebody who's worthy of being imitated. We want to be like someone else so that we too can have the honor we see somebody else get. We want to act like that person. And in that way, we become what we behold. And so we need to consider that when we plan out our lessons. And then that third part is the intellect, or the part of us of reason that's seeking after wisdom and wants to avoid ignorance. So oftentimes in our classroom, when we ask questions, nobody wants to answer because they don't want to look ignorant, or sound stupid, or get it wrong. And so that's what the student, whether the student is 5 or 55, is trying to avoid. So then let's talk about how to play those out. Within the apprenticeship, what we talk about is if these are the parts of a soul that is seated before us, the student, there's times when I see my students not being able to attend. I have had students put their heads down on their desk, and so I'm checking what's going on here, which part of them is needing to be attended to in that moment. Did they have a fight with their parents last night? Or this morning? And there's a physical exhaustion that's happening inside of that body. So I need to be aware of that. But I also need to be aware when I plan a lesson for them and say they're beginning piano lessons. And the thing they need to do right now is just to sit and be still and do their practice. Then the reward for that needs to match that it was a belly thing that they had to overcome. So in that manner, the reward would be to feed the belly. You know, maybe in that time, you'll get 5 M&Ms for every minute, or for every 5 minutes you sit, something like that, until you can grow the physical control over the body. Yet, if I was to apply that same idea to an older adult who's learning the piano, they have the ability to have themselves sit, but what they're longing after, what they're wanting, is the honor of someday being able to play something that can bring joy to others. So they get this future reward of a promise to come. And so we're now speaking more to the chest in that lesson for an adult. For the intellect part of that is when the joy comes from knowing. There's not I can't promise a food reward because it's not a belly issue. I can't offer honor for something. The joy for the intellect is in the knowing, in the comprehending, or the apprehension of the truth. And so when you see the light bulb go off over somebody's head because they saw it, that is its own reward. For me to then offer M&Ms or stickers or even an attaboy isn't appropriate, and it takes away from that. So let's talk it through with a meal. What kind of habits can we create or promises can we offer that help our students orient and order these desires? If the belly part wants to avoid pain at all cost, and the thing it needs is to experience pleasure, what can we provide? And so we can create the habit of fasting. So I'm going to walk this through meals, whether it's a meal in your home or a meal at your school. So how can we fast within the church calendar together as a family or as a community to help override the belly? Or what other hard thing can we practice together? Maybe in your classroom, you set aside a timer and say, for these next 15 minutes, whatever it is, the thing that you need to next work on, which we've identified as parent, teacher, student, then we're all going to work on that thing that we need to work on that's difficult for us, whether it's your math tables or your Latin declensions or the poem you want to memorize. And you set aside time to practice that together, but we're individuals in that moment as well. In a meal, when we're going to talk to the chest part of that desire, where we want honor or glory, one of the things that we do, whether it's at my home or in my classroom, is we will share highs and lows of the day as a way to together remember the good, the things that brought us joy, and to mourn together. So we're going to rejoice and mourn together as a habit to orient the things that need to be honored and remembered. Last night, I had the pleasure of being out to dinner with a few of the people gathered here, and Elliot toasted the guests at the table as a way to honor them. So those are small things we can do to acknowledge these desires that are in our hearts. And then when it comes to the intellect and how to bring that into the feast, it's letting it be what it is and letting our students experience it and enjoy it and come to their own conclusions of what this is so that they might want to replicate it within their own homes or within their friend groups. I've seen students take the same ideas. So my son brought it to school and asked his friends to give him highs, lows, and funnies at the dinner table because they needed to laugh more, particularly during COVID when they were locked on campus. So yeah, then that it becomes its own thing. The other piece of that for the intellect is to acknowledge that words have meaning and to hold them to their meaning. Have you ever had a friend say to you, well, I won't lie to you, blah, 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 blah. Like, I didn't know lying to me was an option. And so to check our words with one another, and that may our words have meaning across the table. Or if somebody says, well, I can't fill in the blank. I can't paint. I can't sail. I can't learn Latin. What if perhaps it's more about, well, you haven't practiced? These are skills that take practice. And so to name that rightly, to remind one another of the truth in that manner, is a way to honor the intellectual need that we all have, that we want knowledge and not ignorance. What do these do if we honor them rightly? So within the apprenticeship, we'll often joke when somebody gets something, you know, and they do it well, I'll offer them candy or stickers, and they'll look at me and say, yeah, that doesn't work. Because they figured it out. That's not the thing that part of them really wants. It's a temporary thing that feels like a patch. And so when you're offered candy or a sticker or a letter grade for something that doesn't align with the kind of thing you did, it doesn't fulfill the desire. So those are the three parts of the soul, as I said, given to us by Socrates, Plato. They core align with what God introduces to us in Genesis, that there's three places that the soul wants to be. We want rest. So when God creates, after 6 days of creation, he rests. And then when he puts order to the society, he tells them to rest, to honor the Sabbath. Not so that we can be chained to the Sabbath, so that the Sabbath can serve us. So then what does that look like in our classroom? If we are all souls that desire this kind of rest, one of the ways that that can look like is acknowledging we're going to do this work, and after this work is done, we're going to do this other thing. We're going to call it good. We're going to review what we did, call it good, and rest from it. So to give them that pattern of work, acknowledge rest, work, acknowledge rest, which is the pattern of what God gave us in Genesis 1. The chest wants honor, right? And it wants to avoid shame. And so and where do we get honor oftentimes? When Chris was introduced, he was introduced as the president. So sometimes it's in a title. It's in the place that we have dominion. We have honor. And we understand hierarchy and authority in those places. And so as young, growing, developing souls, they too want honor or dominion. And so when they're little, we give them dominion over their toys. Because if they don't take good care of them, not much is impacted. Unless it's the Legos that get left out at night, then my feet are impacted and not theirs, right? So the dominion grows after its toys, then they're going to maybe have dominion over plants. Because if they don't take care of a plant, what's at stake here? It's going to be okay, right? Most of us aren't living off of our land. And if we are, the farmers that I know still start their children off with something very small to learn that lesson in. So after plants, they grow in dominion with a pet. Sometimes it starts with a fish or a gerbil before it goes to a cat or a dog, right? And dogs are higher needs than cats in that pecking order. Do we have any cat families here? Don't know if end, okay? And so before it goes to the dominion of a car, where now I'm not just responsible for my life, I'm responsible for all the lives on the road with me. And eventually, a spouse. And you have dominion over that area and how you care for and nurture one another to the glory of God. So those are all preparations for dominion. And then the chest, it's wanting knowledge or ignorance, and that it wants to know God and live for eternity with him. So eternity is written on our hearts. There's the way that it gets taken astray is what often happens among Americans. So who's celebrating their 39th birthday or 29th birthday again and again and again? Do men do this? It's an odd phenomenon that we want to hold on to youth and we think that it's better. What happened to the wisdom of the ages and the wisdom of your grandparents and your great-grandparents being passed down and honored? That memory may be eternal is what we hope for one another. And so that eternity is written on our hearts as well. So the aim here is to cultivate these loves. These are desires, and they have placements. All six of these are oriented toward God. Yeah. So the belly wants God to fill all of my needs. And do I believe he can? And the chest wants to hear God say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." And the intellect longs to know God. I want to be in a place of rest in God's lap. Have you ever pictured yourself in God's lap? When was the last time you rested your head in your mother or your father's lap? Have you held your mom or dad's hand as you walked down the street together? For dominion, we desire actually to care well for the gifts God gave us. We want the responsibility and the authority to do that. And we want to live for eternity with God. All of those six are pointing, there's shards of God's glory in them. And yet there's still too much for me to gaze upon. I can't look at them straight. So a piece of that glory happens for most of us every Sunday with communion, where Christ told us to eat and drink and remember him. Back to the meals. So everything we desire in some way looks like God. But those shards of glory are too strong. So let's look at what this can look like in the home or in the classroom, knowing that that's who we are and that's how he made us. I'd like to summarize it in two ways, and it's interesting compared with what Chris said. I'd call the first one that what we can offer for our students as they're growing is care and support. And the second thing is natural consequences. And so I would hold on to what Chris offered us in that care and support category, that they need to know we're there for them. You know, we show up, we're consistent. If I say I'm going to do something, I do it. And that I've got their back. At the same time, I'm going to let them fail within reason. And so I like your example, Chris. With my kids, I wasn't going to let them fail in the street when they were young. That wasn't an option. But the stove, okay. How many times are they going to touch a hot stove? Once. I'll tell them this is what can happen, and that's it. I'll let them feel the consequence of that one. My kids were the ones that would get me in the most trouble at the playground because they would scale the playground, and I knew they had the skill, so I let them. But everybody else's parents were freaking out. But I was like, if you can climb the tree, you can do it. I don't mind. I would have my nephews come and ask me, put me in the tree, Aunt Andrea, put me in the tree. I said, if you can get there, it's yours. But I can't place you somewhere you're not ready for yet. So the natural consequences. Keeping in mind that our wounds inform and form us. All that is good and holy is bound within our human limitations. So I have physical wounds on my body, and I have invisible wounds on my body that come with me, and they shape who I am. The same thing is true for your students. We need to allow them to happen and not stop, not intervene in the ones that are natural consequences that they're ready for. So what does that look like then? If we need to allow them to form, I recommend, I highly encourage to not let your children treat you in a way that you wouldn't let your friend. So no eye rolling. No disregard. No lacking of response to a question. No ignoring you. It's something that I'm seeing within my generation that's very common. And so, yeah, there's natural consequences for how we treat one another as friends. And they apply within the home and within the classroom. So then how do we help them? If they have these seven desires, you can look at it as the pressures push on these desires, on the humanness of who we already are. What's something to help balance that? I offer questions, two kinds, to ask of them normative questions and to teach them how to ask their own questions. So David Hicks in Norms of Nobility says that the reform of education needs to happen with the teacher and not with the curriculum. So I don't offer you a new curriculum. He says, rather than history be the spine of the curriculum, though, the normative question, the should question, should be the spine. So should Achilles have refused to fight? What do you think? Who's familiar with the story? Yeah, so he should have refused. He shouldn't have refused, says Amanda. Shouldn't have. He should have returned the body. At least. Should he have drugged the body? Oh, that's a different question. We're not asking that one right now. Ah. Should Telemachus leave his home with the suitors abounding? What was that about? He went to find his father. Do you think he thought he was going to find him? I think he had hope. Now we end book one, and he's in a chamber with sheepskin, and he's in a locked door. He's been put there by a nursemaid. And in book two, he comes out changed. There's this rebirth that happens between those two because he needed to grow up. And how does a young man grow up? They leave home, they get challenged. They meet many minds and they go to many cities, as the opening lines tell us of Odysseus. Yeah. Should Aeneas have left Dido? I'm just going to drop them all. For sure, he should have left Dido. Too much of the belly. Yeah. So with that in mind, I'm going to read from Aesop's Fable, The Ant and the Grasshopper. In a field one summer's day, a grasshopper was hopping about, chirping and singing to its heart's content. An ant passed by, bearing along with great toil an ear of corn he was taking into the nest. "Why not come and chat with me," said the grasshopper, "instead of toiling and moiling in that way?" "Well, but I'm helping lay up food for the winter," said the ant, "and I recommend you do the same." "Well, why bother about winter?" said the grasshopper. "We have got plenty of food at present." But the ant went on its way and continued its toil. When the winter came, the grasshopper had no food and found itself dying of hunger, while it saw the ants distributing every day corn and grain from the stores that they had collected in the summer. Is this the version you're familiar with? You might have a different version. What have you heard? Anybody? Am I the only one? The ants reflect on it. Okay, yeah. Sometimes it'll do that. The ants will reflect and comment on the grasshopper's foolishness. Sometimes what else does the grasshopper do? Here he's coming, he's asked for a conversation. Play music, right? Yeah, so it's oftentimes playing music. So, oh, I didn't know that one. Bug's Life. I don't know this one. The ant, the grasshopper takes the ant's food. The steal. Okay. Modern version. Yeah. Well, so I'll ask the question. Should the ant have fed the grasshopper in the winter? Yeah, maybe on the floor. Whether the ant should have fed the grasshopper? Charity would say yes. Come on. The lesson would say no. You should not let a fool wallow in their folly. Uh-huh. Okay, this one didn't. Yeah. Charity is a stronger opinion. And there's an authority that we're leaning on here now, outside of ourselves. Is letting the grasshopper starve to death failing within reason? Is that a natural consequence? So sometimes a natural consequence and love don't align. Yes. If the grasshopper can offer companionship while the ant is working, could the ant offer from the store when the grasshopper is in need? Thank you. Yes. We got another question on the floor. How many ants are going to have to sacrifice their food for this one grasshopper to be able to eat? If there's plenty of food, is that really a question we need to consider? And then utility, I think you tossed on the table here. Is utility on the table? Okay, is there a fool present here or not? And so the context of their relationship would help us answer the question. What are the other ants doing? Ah, there's a hand over here. If you see someone without the world's goods, there is an obligation that the Bible has given us. Thank you. Uh-huh. Right. Yes. So are we going to highlight industry or mercy? What does the ant ask of the grasshopper in exchange for the food? It could be a continued quest. What if it was your own baby ants who would die by extending this food? These are things to be considered when we give answer. One of the questions in my small town of Bellingham, Washington right now is that first responders are now required to carry Narcan. I was like, the medication just left my head. And so the 18, 19, 25-year-olds are asking the question, because that's the world I swim in. Is that right? What are we doing when we provide that in that moment? So might the ant and the grasshopper have anything to offer us in that? So when I have, when the version that I grew up reading of that fable includes the grasshopper singing. So then I would ask you the question, do any of you listen to music while you work? Do any of you wander over to your neighbor's desk during your work hour to have a conversation? I work remotely for Cersei. Cersei's off in North Carolina. I'm in Washington State. So I will often call one of my coworkers and say, hey, I'm wandering by your desk to have a conversation. Can they sacrifice their time to welcome me? Is there space for that? So, in reading stories, one of the first things I typically like to do in a story like this, and I skipped it this time, and I apologize to you, is after the story is read, I ask for the students, somebody, to offer up a narration. Just put it back together for us so we can all hear it. And it helps them build attention skills, which is something we'll talk about in the workshop. Then, at the end of the, after somebody narrates, I'll ask them to tell me, how did the ending of the story make you feel and why? Can you think back to the ending of the story? This one ended with, when the winter came, the grasshopper had no food and found itself dying of hunger, while it saw the ants distributing every day corn and grain from the stores they had collected in the summer. How does that ending make you feel? Afflicted, sad. Say it louder. Jealous. So if I have no food, and I need to go to the ant because I'm a sluggard, and the ant just tells me no and closes the door, how do I become wise? Motivated? Charlie would have a great conversation now. Because the intent of the author. So if all things have a shard of God's glory inside of them, then might the author have one intent and there's something else that God could have us learn? Is that possible? So after we read a story together, I ask for a narration. I ask them, how does the ending make you feel and why? Because identifying our feelings at the end of these kinds of stories helps us know later when I feel that feeling again, is that a feeling I should follow or a feeling I should avoid? How did it go in the story for this person when I felt that way? So it helps to acknowledge those desires, those feelings. And then we engage with the should questions and comparing using all of the five common topics, which are the five common questions that one can ask. And yet, David Hicks tells us that the mark of an ineffective teacher is to answer the question before it has been asked. Then what are we supposed to do? That means I can't always be the one asking the question. So one of the things that I've done with one of my classrooms was I wanted them to do that. I wanted them to engage in asking their own questions. I was given a textbook for U.S. history, 7th grade, that they had to teach. I had to teach through this textbook. And I said, well, I can't teach them how to read with this textbook because it's just all pre-regurgitated. You know, they can find the little box with the bolded word and find this pulled out. So that wasn't how I was going to engage with this. What was the skill I could teach throughout this class? History, to whatever extent they may or may not remember if I focus on names and dates. But if I focus on getting to know people and how they related to one another, I might have a chance. So I exposed them to the five common questions, the five common topics that we all use all the time, whether we're aware of their names or not. Once I expose them to those, are we familiar with those? I don't want to waste anybody's time here. Anybody not familiar? Thank you. So then tell me one common topic. Those of you who know you are literarily rich, help those who are literarily poor. Definition. So in the ant and the grasshopper, I might want to define what does it mean to be an ant? What kind of a thing is an ant? What kind of a thing is a grasshopper? What kind of a thing is food? We could think through that. What's another one? Comparison. So I can actually compare those two things, or I can just take the grasshopper and I can compare him to a rug or a blender or a light, something completely different. Or I can compare the word giving, the verb, to another verb, keeping, and see what I find. To better understand both of those, I often will ask my students to come up with what they want to compare. I might pick one, or I'll give them the issue and they can pick anything from the issue. That way they're invested in that as well. What's the third common place we can go to gather information? Relationship, I heard, and we'll go there next. So relationship, when I ask that one of my kiddos, I say, well, who are your relatives? Who are your relatives? Name a relative. Grandma. So grandma came when? When was she born? Before me. So when I'm looking for relation, did y'all say we're on relationship, right? Okay, all of a sudden I confused myself. So grandma came before you. So what came before this situation? So in order for the grasshopper to even show up and ask for food, what had to come before that? He wasn't gathering. Those kinds of things we're going to talk about. And then what comes after you? Your children. So what comes after this in the story? What's going to happen to the grasshopper if we do feed him? He'll figure it out. Yeah, he might have a chance to perceive truth and goodness in being fed. Yeah. I'm looking at the time. Do y'all know my playground story? Did I tell it last year? Okay, so I was living in an apartment complex, playing on the playground on a Saturday, when strangers came up to the playground and said, hey, do you want a free snow cone? I was like, I want two. It's really hot, I'll take two snow cones. And they said, okay, great. Come back here tomorrow morning at this time, and we're going to pick you up, take you on a bus. We're going to go to church. After church, we're going to get snow cones, and then we'll bring you right back to this playground. Sweet. My mom would get me dressed, put coins in my pocket, and send me out the door. That would not happen today. I'm 50. No shame in that. And so I learned from that experience, church is good. Church tastes great. Right? And then we moved and we moved and we moved, and I got invited to church again in third grade. What do I know? Wait, church is good. So I went. That's what I learned. I got welcomed in, and I got fed as the stranger who had done nothing. That's what came before, so that's why I share that story, right? So that when I was in high school, I got invited to church again because my life was full of moving. And that time, I said, no, that's all right. I already checked that box. But what happened in the middle? Seeds. Different kinds of seeds happened in the middle that told me church isn't answering those questions any longer. And I wasn't understanding what I was being told. Church would say one thing, and my mom at home would tell me that I was a hypocrite because I would go to church on Sundays and I would fight with my sister the rest of the week. And I did. Right? So understanding what comes before and after is vital to understanding the issues. Circumstance was the next one. So what's going on in the circumstances? Circumstances often determines the issue. At the same time in different places, what's happening? So we're going to look at that in our story. So at the moment when this one aunt is getting asked for food, what else is happening? Hundreds and thousands of other ants are gathering food. That one ant doesn't operate in isolation, so that there is a plentifulness for this colony. And then you can keep asking circumstances that go farther out. What is that? What's happening in the rest of the forest? What's happening outside in the neighborhood? So forth and so on to figure out issues. And then I think we're on our last one. Testimony or authority is another word, right? So then we're going to ask, and we've already done that. What does the Bible have to say? What was another authority that was given up here? Oh, charity. So we went to the muses in a way, right? So those kinds of authorities can help inform our answers. So I've taught my students these five common kinds of questions they could ask. And then I would give them this history textbook because I was required by my Christian classical school to teach by this book, a section to read, and to come back to class with two questions. And they're like, well, Mrs. Lipinski, you want me to answer the questions, right? I said, no, I just want you to come with questions that we've answered. No, just come with the questions. It was a really hard paradigm to shift. And so they would come with their two questions, and we sat to where we all faced one another for conversation to happen, and I would ask them to ask one another your question. And so then if somebody else in the classroom could answer the question, they would. And if nobody else in the class knew the answer, and I did, I would answer for them. But if I didn't know the answer, I would tell them, that's a great question, I'll look it up and I'll get back to you. And I had to write down the notes, do the research, and come back with the answer. And so I had to be consistent in what I said to show that what they brought to class mattered. That happened long enough, I don't even know how long, before the students were trying to stump one another. They figured out they wanted to come to class with a question that nobody else could answer, not even me, so that they could get the honor and answer the question, provide the joy in one another's minds of knowing. And so getting to ask their own questions was its own self-correcting mechanism because they learned over time which questions generated conversation. Those were the kinds of questions they wanted to ask. They didn't want the kind of question that would, you know, stop deadpan. So I didn't have to teach the quality of question. The engagement of our entire class taught the quality of the question. Because the quality of one's question determines the quality of one's life. So that's the goal I had for that class. Another way to help teach them questions is to give them a quote from a story that you're reading. Whether it's before or after you've read the book, I recommend the after, but you can do it before as a preview. And then have them, this is a Joshua Gibbs idea, have them generate the same number of questions around that quote as the number of words in it. So I'm thinking all of you have paper in front of you. Here's your quote. So if you would write this one down, it's from Philo of Alexandria. He says, "Be kind, for everyone you know is fighting a great battle." How many words does that have? Be kind, for everyone you know is fighting a great battle. Words. 11. We'll begin to generate 11 questions. Five common places. You can ask what kind of a thing is any one of those words. Definition. Compare any of those words to themselves or to something else. You can gather up testimony from somebody else about any of these ideas. You can ask what came before or after relationship. And you can ask something about circumstance, what's going on at the same time. What intrigues you in that? Looking at her paper right here, and I don't see 11 questions yet. Anybody write fast enough to have 11 in two minutes? I'm not expecting that. So why don't we share some, and so you can grab from your neighbors. What does it mean to be kind? Thank you. Is this statement true? Thank you. Okay, how does me being kind affect others in their battles? Thank you. Who defines good? Yes. What caused the battle? When can we win? Who is everyone? What kind of battle? How are you fighting the battle? What does the Bible say about fighting the battle? Is fighting a physical thing or is it a metaphor? Is there both a physical, a visible, and an invisible world? How can I be kind as I am also fighting? What are the qualities of kindness? Thinking about the people you know, how does their age affect their battle? What is the function of for, F-O-R, in this sentence, as opposed to F-O-U-R? Just check it. Yes. Thank you. How does being kind compare to being loving? What defines a great battle? How do I respond if others are not kind to me? And what does it mean to know someone? Don't cowards run from battles? Who represents kindness in the Bible? You want some more examples? Are all battles the same? Is the lesson to be learned more important than the kindness to be shown? Thank you. Why are we fighting? What kinds of battles do you think are being fought? How long do I have to be kind? Just want to clarify. That's a clarifying question. Ah. So those others, are they fighting alone or do they have an army fighting with them? Who is the author of this quote? How can I partner with the one who is fighting? Thank you. What's the difference between being kind and being nice? What gifts do I have that can show kindness? What if I'm not kind? Do we have to fight in the battle? Can we just be exempt? How might this author, I'll tell you, Philo of Alexandria's idea, a definition of kindness, be different than what I'm seeing today? Does kindness hold danger for us sometimes? Is everyone fighting the same great battle? Is kind always good? I don't know that it's beautiful, according to Chris. Does the author want us to be kind in an active or a passive way? Thank you for thinking with me. I hope that these will sit with you as we sit together for this next day and a half now, these 2 days. Treating children like persons, then, when I hear their questions to something like this, I'm seeing into their soul. Because the kind of question we each ask is reverberating within our own sense of self and our own view of the world and the story that we're living in, the questions that we're already asking. They're not separate from this new question I just wrote down. So I'm getting a glimpse into what matters to them. And maybe I can get a glimpse into how tired they are, confused, or strong. Children and adults, we are making decisions every day, throughout the day, and we need the skills or the tools to be able to do that. So I want to encourage my students to learn how to think, and it often is rooted in their questions to do that. But then I need to give them the tools to do the thinking. So I shared with you the 5 common topics as one of those. Another way, then, how do we order all of these ideas that we've come up with? How do we put them into an order that makes sense and is supportive of something, that points towards something else, like that actually gives an answer? And then how do I express that well? And so that is the liberal or liberating art of rhetoric, which is decision-making in community. Within CIRCE, we have the Lost Tools of Writing that teaches that. And when we practice these skills, we practice it on literature often, or in math, history, science, anything besides the things that are most dear to my heart. I can't practice this new skill of thinking necessarily on the things that are most dear to my heart at first. I need to learn how to use the tool over here on some other idea that's not as important to me before I can go do it for the things that matter to me, right? I got to make sure I'm not going to cut my finger off with this new tool first. So I encourage you to find a way to do that. And in so doing, what happens by us having these conversations is I don't have to tell my students the answers to these questions. Because if I tell them the answer to the question, it's still my answer. I own it. But when they perceive it, it's theirs. They own it. And they're developing judgment. And so they can practice judging whether or not somebody like Telemachus should have gone on a journey, because it's not so hard, before they have to figure out, is it time for them to launch out for their journey? Where it's a little harder. Where does that go? So that's how we cultivate judgment. So I hope that by opening us with scripture, I point you back to 1 Corinthians to remember, to hold on to, that we have the mind of Christ by which to do this. And we can trust the Holy Spirit who resides in each one of our students. Thank you.
Exhausting questions before laying another piece of literature in front of them. Yeah. That's another perspective.
Yeah.
Is there a line that you feel like is counterproductive? Or when do you sense those things?
Yeah, you don't want to exhaust them, right? To where too many unanswered questions or too many unanswered questions. And I've done that, and so I've had to learn. So you just have to know your students and pay attention. I go back to, I'm pretty sure it's Charlotte Mason, is you want to leave them wanting more in whatever your lesson is. And so the same thing happens here. And so it's a feel. I don't have an exactness to it.
Which is kind of like you put it actually in a term, 11 words, 11 questions.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So I let the quote do that for us.
Yeah.
And then in the conversation, I mean, we obviously, there's how many of us, and we're adults here. So we went way over 11. And that's fine, right? But it's, again, knowing our students and what we're capable of. And each of these questions, I hope for you, shined another light on another shard, on another glimmer of glory of what's possible in contemplating together.
Others? I'll go here and then over here.
Hi there. You talked about the cycle of work, acknowledge, rest.
Yeah.
That acknowledge piece, I've always thought of it as a work, rest, rhythm. But what is the significance of
calling
that?
It good?
Yes.
Yeah. So let me try to tell it in a story. I'm a sailor. I grew up sailing. My mom raced boats. She taught me how to sail. I taught my sons how to sail. And when my oldest son applied to the Merchant Marine Academy, I said, hey, you should probably put on that application that you know how to sail. He's like, well, but I don't really know how to sail. I was like, but you do. He's like, well, I've just sailed with you, Mom. And so I was like, all right, that's fine. I signed him and his little brother and the buddy and myself up for a sailing class in Galveston, Texas, where we spent a week learning how to sail. And at the end, we were assessed in two manners. We had a paper exam to make sure we knew all the laws of the water, as well as a practical exam where we had to be on a boat with our instructor and maneuver it and follow his orders, take care of the boat and all the people on it, get them all back to shore safe, right? At the end of that exam, not only do both of my sons pass, you know, because they were only taught by their mom, they were offered jobs. Right. And so remind me of your question and I will make the connection. Yeah. And so I think in a small part for my son there, we had just sailed together. And I had not stopped along the way and acknowledged his skills as they progressed. Yeah. And so he didn't see anything happening. This is just because in a way it is. It's just who we are. That's what it means to be a Lipinski. We sail. And so what I learned from that was I need to stop along the way and help them recognize what they have gained. We have to call it good. Does that help? Matt?
Okay. We'll take this last question, okay. And then I learned I was just plain wrong about lunch. Naomi, don't go away, because I've got a little role for you, but we'll round this out here, and no worries.
So first of all, thanks, Andrea, for your talk. I've taught a variety of different ages of kids, and what if they just don't get the most important question? So you give them all the space to come up with questions, and there's a couple that are just, they've got to ask it and answer it of this great classic piece of literature, and they don't generate that question.
They won't generate.
Yeah, they just haven't generated the one of the greatest questions that every kid or adult or person who reads the work of literature must ask. Do you provide it?
Keep providing types.
Yeah.
So if they can't see it and generate it, so I go back up in the lesson. So we teach mimetically. And in so doing, anywhere that I'm in the lesson, if my student's not seeing what I want them to see, I go back up. So if I'm expecting them to prepare their own questions that are to, and there's not just one question. I do want to say that. So I think as adults, we think that we have to get the right question. And there's not the right question. All of us had questions here today that are going to point us towards something else. And so by asking any question, I will answer everything. I will read everything better. So I don't think that you have to get to the right question, because even if I was to ask whether or not Little Red Riding Hood should have opened the door at Grandma's house, there's a lot of other, like, that may not be the best question, but because I'm going to look at the story with that one question, I'll look at the whole story better. So don't disregard the question. And if you're trying to get them to get the question, I would sit with that for a little bit to see.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it's that they get off track, and sometimes it's just about their feelings, which is, as you said, is very important.
Right.
But if there's an authorial, if there's a point that the author uniquely makes and you're trying to tie those themes, there might be a million ways to get to that. Maybe a theme is a better than, say, one question. But
yeah.
So you just go back up in the lesson and still work at it so that they can try to generate the questions that get maybe to the theme or
right.
whatever.
But they can't see something they're not ready to see. So I can lay out a feast, but I can't require you to eat. And so that's the same thing in my classroom. I lay out the feast and then I stop back and I wait watchfully and I pray, Lord, have mercy. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I drink my tea and I stay quiet. That's what my fellow teachers have identified. They're like, you just keep drinking. I was like, because I'm keeping my mouth full so that I'm leaving space for everybody else to do the talking. And I wait watchfully for the Holy Spirit to descend. I wait for Pentecost. And so if they're not ready, I'm going to go for another type, and I'm going to go for another type. But if I say it to them, it's still mine. And I'm not a very trustworthy guide any longer. I just wait.
Wow. With that, thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
That was Cultivating Judgment, Cultivating Independence by Andrea Lipinski. You've been listening to a recording provided by Gutenberg College. You can find more information about Gutenberg College on our website at www.gutenberg.edu. Any broadcast or retransmission of this recording without the express written permission of Gutenberg College and the conference speaker is prohibited. Thank you for listening.